All right, good morning everyone. So
indeed, I talk about place sales. But first I have to make clear that I study place sales as a way to understand the memory processing. So that's based on the assumption that place sales, not just the one that respond to place, respond to location in space, but also encode the memory trace about the space. So in this way, you can think about the place sale activity is actually a memory code for space. Now, when we talk about memory, there are different processing stages. So during the memory formation, for example, I walk in this room for the first time, I need to look around and see how the room is laid out. So we receive all the sensory information through the eyes and bring it to my brain and then form a memory code, presumably the place cell response to this space. So memory formation is the brain's response to a new sensory input. And then after memory code is formed, it can be retrieved during memory retrieval. In most cases, the retrieval is triggered by some kind of external cue, like a partial sensory cue. Like for example, I walk by this door, even though I'm not inside, I can kind of retrieve how this room is laid out. So for memory retrieval, there's some kind of interaction between the internal processing and external cue. So the external cue triggers some kind of internal processing such that the entire memory trace can be recovered. And also, there's a separate memory consolidation stage, that is, that the memory code can be reactivated even in absence of any external cue, for example, during sleep or resting. So the brain can just internally bring back the memory trace and reactivate it. Through this kind of repetitive reactivation, presumably we can induce further synaptic plasticity for a cellular memory consolidation, or can transfer the memory out of the hippocampus to the neocortex for systems memory consolidation. All right, so then let me just show you an example of how we exactly do experiments to have a hold of a memory code, what I exactly mean about the memory code, how we would measure it. And then we can use that to study memory formation or consolidation. I'm sure many of you know how exactly we do experiments, but just to bring everyone to the same page, I'll show you a simple experiment here. This is a rat on a maze. This is a figure 8-shaped maze. There are two reward sites. The animal's task is to alternate between the two reward sites to get a food reward. So the animal is started with this reward site, it can travel through to the central arm, and then get to the right reward site and eat there. And after that, he can travel again the central arm and now reach the left reward site to get food. So the animal's task is alternate between those two trajectories for food. So he can do this for half an hour, can run each trajectory for like 30 to 50 times. So while the animal is doing this, we have, of course, electrodes implanted into the animal's brain, and kind of a common recording area in our experiment is the hippocampus CA1 area, but we can also record any other brain area. In this case, we record the visual cortical neurons. So we all know the hippocampal neurons are place cells. This is just to show you a single place cell, so activity. So now the figure 8 maze is plotted somehow upside down. You have these two reward sites here, the left and the right reward site. Each red dot represents the animal's location when this particular neuron fires a single spike. So it's all the red dots accumulate at this area while the animal doing this task for half an hour. So we can see all the spikes fired by this particular place cell. So we say this is a place field, that this is where the cell fire. Of course, we record many neurons at the same time. Here, just to show you four example neurons. We have the red one, green, and the blue, and the yellow. You can imagine when the animal is running the trajectory from right to left, you can see those neurons going to fire one after another in the sequential order. And we can plot here as a firing pattern. Now, the trajectory from right to left is a linearized and plot as x-axis here. So this is just showing the four neurons. When the animal to travel this trajectory just once, a single lap, you can see that this neuron going to fire a train of action potential and then followed by other neurons. So you can see that when the animal travels through this trajectory, you have this firing sequence. So we believe that such firing sequence is actually a spatial code for this particular spatial trajectory. We can also think of this as a memory code for the trajectory. That's because this sequence is unique to this trajectory. You know, when the animal is running a different trajectory, like from right to left to right, you can have a different sequence and also involve probably other group of neurons. And even for the neurons of fire, within this central arm or this kind of segment of the track, the firing pattern of those neurons can actually distinguish the two trajectories from right to left and left to right.
So that's just shown
in this example
here.
Now I mark the central arm here. This is start and end. Animal travel always travel from start point to end. So I plot this part of the track now as the x-axis. So this is the position. The animal always travel from the start to the end. You can see that this nine simultaneous recorded neurons, they all fire when the animal travels through this portion of the track. But you can see when the animal running a trajectory from left to right, and also when the animal running from right to left, the firing pattern of the same neurons now seems different. So even so those cells have this the place field and the central arm, which is shared by two trajectories. The firing patterns are different. So they just mean that the place cells probably not just place cells. They can also contain information about where the animal come from and where the animal going to go. So this is probably related to a more general feature of the hippocampal place cells, you know, they encode in general like episodic-like memories.
So if you zoomed in on these traces like the purple and the yellow, would you find that cycle by cycle there's the proper relationship that you're supposed to get from this phase recession idea?
Yeah.
You would find each yellow spike comes back for a purple spike or whatever?
Yeah, they all have a good phase precession. So.
Not each, but pretty more of, far more often than chance. Every spike in biology is
right.
Yeah, the phase precession is quite robust. You can look at those neurons with different firing rate. We actually check. So the one question is the cells. You can see that, like, for example, this one has a higher firing rate. The animal on this trajectory is a lower firing rate on different trajectories. And the question is whether phase precession actually depends on the firing rate. It turned out that whether it's a high firing rate or low firing rate, the precession is always there. Yeah. All right. So. Given the assumption that such a sequence is kind of memory code, then we can ask questions related to like a memory consolidation. For example, in this particular study, we test the one important idea in the standard memory consolidation theory,
which is basically saying there should be
coordinated reactivation in the hippocampus and the cortex, such that the hippocampus can talk to the cortex. So that's probably
by
a system memory consolidation so that they can transfer the memory out of the hippocampus. So in this particular study, we just try to test whether there is sleep reactivation in the visual cortex and whether the reactivation in the cortex and hippocampus are coordinated.
So
in this case, when the animal running this trajectory from right to left,
now you can see
the firing sequence of the hippocampus and also the firing pattern in the visual cortex.
This is
when the animal is running the track. Then we look at the exactly two groups of neurons while the animal now in slow wave sleep
right after running the track.
Very often, we kind of see that the firing sequence associated with the track running is replayed during the slow wave sleep. And also, the firing pattern in the visual cortex when the animal is running the track also replayed in the slow wave sleep. And we also found that the there's a tendency for the two areas to replay the same trajectory at the same time. So there's a coordinated memory replay. So, yeah?
The time scale for the visual cortex and the hippocampus is different. So is the idea that the hippocampus is not driving the visual cortex? Are they independent?
Well, the time scale actually is similar. So we can compute the average time scale of the replay in both areas. It turned out they're similar. They're all kind of 7 times faster than the sequence during the track running. But in this particular study, actually, we were unable to determine which area drive another. It just simply, we don't have enough replay events. But we can still say that there's a coordination between the two areas.
Those two replays are not simultaneous.
No, it's not. Yeah. But we do have other examples to show the simultaneous replay for the exact same trajectory.
When is the visual cortex where?
This is the deep layers of
V1.
V1?
Yeah.
So now, how many synapses are you using from the examples?
I think a minimum five.
Minimum five?
Yes. There are many.
So you cannot, and at least I have a hard time imagining that hippocampal replay is driving that one, or vice versa.
I
can't be simple thing like these groups of cells drove it, like five synapses.
I think at least to my understanding of current memory storage theory, that should be the case. You know. Go ahead.
Can I just quibble with that? I mean, from your retina to the infrontemporal cortex is many synapses. You expect it to be very tightly driven.
That's right.
So because it's so probabilistic, right? During behavior, I understand that if there's a neuron that fires at some place, there's a certain sensory input that drives the neuron. Because all the set of neurons that respond are firing at high rates, and they're firing pretty reliably. Forget 10 millisecond jitter. But here, the replay itself is pretty noisy. So what are the chances that this thing can be propagated?
Well, they're going to be propagated anyway. I think they're going to propagate
it. That's one of the best examples.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, but replay occurs what? What fraction of spike show replay?
It's around, in the hippocampus, about 10%.
5 to 10%.
10% that you add. Well, I would say 10% is still significant and impressive.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Because during the sleep, they're always going to be noisy. You know, the brain is doing all sorts of things, the replay all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And also in terms of like a coordination, I don't see a reason why you should not see replay in the visual cortex. If the cortex,
whether one can draw a plausible hypothesis or how one noisy.
Yeah. Well, the hypothesis that we can draw, but here I just admit that the data cannot really make a conclusive statement about that hypothesis. That's because we don't have enough events to make that statement. Yeah.
So
we can block C1. That's what you're saying. We haven't done it. That's one way. Yeah.
I also have a hard time seeing replay between left and right there. I mean, if you actually look at the transitions between the different colors, it's just not clear which one comes first. The trains are very overlapping.
The visual cortical replay
detection is a little bit harder. I agree with that. It's simply because they have a baseline firing. But if you look at the kind of a peak, the spectrum, you look at the peak firing, and there is an order there. And when you look at this spectrum, look at this peak, you can draw a sequence. So that's
actually how we use it to detect. But if you just see the firing pattern,
there's a similarity here. If you look at the other firing patterns, you can clearly see they're just noisy. There's no similarity there. So anyway, I'm not going to go all the details about this, but just saying that we can use the firing sequence as a way to study memory code formation and consolidation. But actually, that's not my focus of today's talk. So my goal here is to bring some kind of new understanding relative to memory retrieval. As I said,
memory retrieval implies some kind of interaction
between the external cue and internal reactivation of the memory code. I think the retrieval is pretty hard to study in animals. We don't know exactly what the animal is thinking. Okay? There are many hypotheses. For example, the kind of so-called replay during the resting state or awake replay may be related to memory retrieval.
And also in humans
studies, we know that indeed when people retrieve some kind of a memory, there is a reactivation of the hippocampal neurons. But besides that, there's not much else we can say about it. So I hope that at the end of the talk, we can learn something new. All right, so the story is all started with something very different, which is related to Alzheimer's disease. At the beginning, I thought this can always kind of trivial question, and I don't have much motivation to study, but in the end, I believe that the finding is much more interesting than I thought. So, okay, the question relates to the disease. We know that the many people study Alzheimer's disease for a long time, so we know a great deal at both the pathological level and also the behavioral level. You know, those patients, they show a very prominent memory deficit. Most obviously, they have a hard time to form new episodic memory. On the other hand, at the pathological level, we also know a great deal. So there are two characteristics of the disease. One is the beta amyloid. Another one is shown here, a so-called tau pathology. So inside this patient's brain, there's a lot of tau protein somehow abnormally phosphorylated. So they can abnormal tau protein that get aggregate together and form tangles inside the cell. Okay, and somehow those tangles lead to the death of the neurons. So in the end, neurons in the memory area, the hippocampus and the cortex, they die. So we can think, of course, because you have neurons dying in the memory area, you're going to lead to memory deficit. But I think a more interesting question is what aspect of memory processing is really wrong? And whatever we observe from the patient, it has to be mediated by the neurons, by the remaining neurons in the brain. You know, in order to understand why particular symptoms show up, we need to understand what those neurons are doing. So that's kind of a primary motivation for this. So the question is simply how how pathology like this can lead to a memory deficit. So of course, we can think about place cells and to study the problem related to spatial memory deficit in those patients. And then we have to do this in animal models. In this particular animal, the so-called the TG4510 mice, and here I call it tau mice, okay? So this is a transgenic animal. There's an overexpression of a mutated version of a human tau gene in the forebrain. So this is the forebrain specific. And in this mouse, they show a lot of tau tangles and extensive neurodegeneration. And also at the behavioral level, there's a clear spatial memory deficit at the age of our animal in our recording. So the deficit is measured by the water maze.
The pathology, so when you say expression of a human, either a human gene, is that's a mouse analog, homologue of that gene, or are they actually inserted the human gene?
They insert the human gene. So this is
the human gene,
yeah.
The mouse gene.
Yeah, this is knocking, yeah. So this gene is responsible for the frontal temporal dementia in humans. It's not a really Alzheimer's disease gene. But somehow, this is the only gene that can model the tau pathology in the mouse. So there's a lot of model for the beta amyloid, but very little for tau. So this actually show a very good progression of the tau pathology, which mimic the human patient pretty well. So it's age-dependent progression of the disease. Anyway, so we're not going to get into the details about the disease. Here, just to show you our recording, it's just the recording area. And that's the tip of the electrode that we've implanted. We record from the CA1 area. This side, we show the hippocampus in the tau animal, and compare it with a normal hippocampus in a white-type animal. You can see that the hippocampus kind of shrink. And also, if you look at the CA1 layer cell number, there's only about 40% cells remained in this particular animal at this age.
You just look at the overall the brain.
Brains the shrink, the forebrain, with the cerebellum, the hindbrain normal. So. Yeah, then the gyrus is much more severely degenerated.
Is it across the whole axis of the hippocampus?
The bilateral and also more severe on the dorsal. So, yeah. So the CA3 is relatively less affected than CA1 and dentate gyrus. Okay, anyway, we record the CA1 neurons in the wild type animal and then the tau animal. Of course, while the amyloid running the track. So this is a simplified version of the track. This is just there are two reward sites here, amyloid run from one reward site to another and the back. So it's just running back and forth for like 15 minutes. The animal can run between 10 to 30 laps per session.
Sorry.
Yeah.
What is the age of these animals, and at what age did you show those brain deficits?
They're 7 to 9 months old. They're all the same.
So all of these are
same? Yeah, they're 7 to 9 months. Yeah. So they just mentioned that there are two trajectories I'm running from here to there and back. Okay, just alternate between two trajectories for food. Now let's look at the normal place cell. I think I overdo this, but just try to show that the place cell is very stable in a wild type of animal. Now the particular trajectory from this reward site to this, now the linear rise plotted as x-axis. This is just a lap number. So first lap means the animal travels through the trajectory first time in this session. And also I have to mention that the track is familiar. The animal has been doing this for at least 2 weeks. So it's a well-trained animal. So you can see that is a cell fire spike train, like there's one location here, another location somewhere there. Second lap, and called all the other laps, just showing that the firing location of the cell is very stable. So this is a very reliable response. Now let's just, we can compute the firing rate by counting all the spikes from all the labs divided by the occupancy time at this location. So this is the place field of the cell. Now let's look at what the neuron from a tau animal look like. So this is what it looked like. So clearly you can see this is a big difference. It seems that the cell fire all over the places. And if you compute the firing rate position, you can see there's multiple peaks and also the baseline is not zero. In a white type of animal, there's a very clean baseline here. Okay. Now let's just see what exactly is wrong here. So we just look at the same data, but in a slightly different way, which is plot the spike trains lap by lap. So there's the first lap of the white type neuron, and then this first lap is the transgenic animal neuron. So if you just look at the spike train, it's actually hard to see a difference here. And then you plot another lap, again, it's hard to see a difference. But the problem is that if you plot two laps together, now you see the difference. The white type of animal, the firing location is very stable between the two labs. But now you look at the tau animal, you look at the firing location of its neuron, the shift lap by lap. So this is this kind of extreme level of instability of the firing location. So every single lab, the cell still try to fire at its restricted places. But the second time around, it already forget where they used to fire. Right? So the firing location shift from one lab to another. So this is just a plot again to let you see a better picture here. You see the firing location there, and then the shift to there, and then shift it back. And sometimes from here and shift to this way. So this is...
Supposing you had a neuron which didn't have any place response at all in the wild type, and you just amplified its response, would it start to look a little bit like the tau? In other words, if there was no peak whatsoever, just background activity.
I don't think so. So we can actually compute that. If a cell is fired randomly, we can quantify like a spatial specificity. Mm-hmm. And in this case, we can also quantify the spatial specificity. It turned out the
cell is not fired completely randomly. It's not completely.
Right. And also each lap, it looked like
it's not randomly fired.
It's not like spikes spread to the entire track. It's just there's still firing location there.
Yeah. So does it stabilize during the session? It looks like the towards the end is more stable now than the beginning.
It looked like that's the case for this particular neuron, but actually you look at all different neurons, they just shift around. They all have different stability, different dynamics.
Go ahead. This one's clearly shifting in a backward direction, like a back and forth, effect there with the backward shifting of the center of mass. Is that very atypical?
No, we haven't found the kind of regularity in the kind of direction of shifting. We haven't found that. So.
Best organized town neuron or the worst organized, and is that the best or the worst? In other words, could you find a normal cell that looked like this, and could you find a tau cell that looked like that?
We found all sorts of cells, but we can look at the kind of quantification here. So this is just computer stability. The stability is basically you take spectrum one lab, spectrum another lab, a computer correlation there, and then you average among all the combined labs. We do this for each neuron, and then this is just for all the neurons we record it. It's just the distribution, the histogram of the stability. You can see that for the Y-type neurons, most of them, you know, they have a very high stability, close to one. But then for most of the tau neurons, you know, the stability is very low. So, so we take a spectrum of one lab, and a spectrum of another lab. Then we just compute the correlation between the two labs. So this is versus position.
So it's just all combinations.
For each neuron, we do it for all combinations, then average. Mm-hmm. So we have one value for each neuron.
So have you checked, I think based on some of the questions people are asking, like, is there any systematic pattern? Like imagine, or Jim was saying, that cell was backward expansion was massive. You simply did random dot product.
In early analysis, we did try to look at the exact shifting in the location, to identify the peak and how the exact shift, we couldn't come up with a regular pattern there.
Yeah. Like, I mean, we had studied a knockout mouse, and we had seen massive disruption in place cells, and so on, like knockout. And what we found is that if you find, define overall very smoothed out pattern in one trial, then you can actually track the evolution across trials, no matter how noisy. You can do, I don't know, a couple of analysis, like compute the correlation between trial to trial versus random trials.
They're not completely random. I'm going to show you some data later. They're not completely random. I'm just saying.
The shift across trials, is there a pattern? Is there a systematic shift or is it completely
random? We looked hard to try to figure out, but we couldn't. Okay. But it's clear they're not random. Okay. Right. Yeah. All right, so that means if you look at a single neuron, the firing location shift lab by lab. Now our question is, you know, what if we record many neurons together? How do they shift? They shift all together or they shift randomly? You know, they shift independently.
So here just show you
the multiple neuron firing pattern. Again, this is a lab, only show you five labs, and this is the position when I'm running from here to there. So this is a
Y-type
animal. We plot six neurons here. You know, you can see that the cell fire one after another, and the animal travels through the track from left to right. And this firing pattern is very consistent, okay? And it always occurs at the same location of the position of the track. So this is a stable firing sequence. But now you look at the neurons recorded from the tail mouse. Clearly you see that the sequence here. So sequence is maintained. And even though at the single neuron level, you know, the firing location shift lab to lab, for example, lab 1 to lab 2, this bottom neuron, the shift to the left side, and then this red neuron, all the shift to the left. So they all shift together such that you can draw this line to see the firing sequence is actually maintained. So this becomes a little bit more interesting than we thought. You know, it looks like even though the cell firing location shift lab by lab, but they seem do it in a coordinate fashion, okay? So there's a pattern here.
You know, the animals are alternating, right, going back and forth.
Yeah, this is a single trajectory only from this reward side to this, and this just plots the pattern of five laps.
But only in one direction.
One direction, yes. All right, here just to show you more data, just saying it's not just that particular animal show this. And
show another.
By type of animal, there's two more mutant animal. You can still see those sequences.
Shift from one lab to another location.
Shift around from based on lab to lab. This is another animal. We have only a full cell, but clearly you can still see the lineup with a certain sequence. So that just means that, you know, somehow the CA1 cell population, they kind of form a firing pattern, but somehow it's kind of floating on the track, just like Jim said a couple of days ago. So they're not really anchored to the position, right? We tried to find a way to quantify this observation, that is the fixed pattern, but also is not anchored to place. So the way of quantification here is like this. I'm not going to go to detail, but just show you what we did. We can talk about the detailed analysis later. So basically what we did is we assign identity to neurons. Like I say, we have six neurons here. We say A, B, C, D, E, F, right? And then we compute the cross-correlation for the entire session between two cells, like A and B, right? Based on the cross-correlation peak, we can determine A fire before B, right? You can order them up, A, B. We do this for all the pairs, and then just chain them up. So we come up with a template sequence for a certain session. And then what we did is to see how often this sequence show up while the animal running lab by lab, and also where exactly the sequence show up, right? So we do it first for pairwise, then we chain them up into a long sequence.
I see.
Yeah. So we counted the number of sequence in a session, but also compare the number to the kind of randomly generated sequence, right? So we can take a template and shuffle like for 1,000 times, and then recount all the number of sequences. So the real number of sequence per session is computed at the z-score relative to randomly generated distribution. Okay, so zero, that's what we expect. That's the mean expected value from random sequence. So we can see that the number of sequence per session is comparable between white type and tau mouse. That just shows that even the tau mouse, they are stable sequences, even though their firing location shift around. And also we quantify the lab-to-lab location shift. See how the sequence location shift from one lab to another. You can see that there's a dramatic increase in the tau mouse in the location shift. And also you may notice in some of the animals for a given lab, there are multiple sequences in tau mouse. In white type mouse, often you only see one sequence. Okay. Quantify the number of sequences per lab. Indeed, there's a small increase in tau animal in the number of sequences per lab, but this increase is not significant. All right, so that means there are sequences in the tau animal, but not anchored to a particular location. Now we're just asking, what if we go ahead.
To say that if you could just try to record these cells as place cells, you would think they didn't have any, right? Because they'd be sort of spread all over. This one particular cell would fire in many different locations depending on the sequence sort of shifting around. So its place cell receptive field or place cell field would be just spread out all over the place. Only because you measure the sequence that you know that it has some knowledge of place relative to the other place. Or, well, there is. You see what I'm saying? If you had not kept track of per lab, then this one cell would fire all over the place. Is that true?
Actually, I'm reluctant to call them place cell anymore.
Well,
okay.
Is it would not look like a place cell.
But maybe, have you quantified that? What's the, let's say, information content?
I did.
And how much is it below chance level?
It's higher than chance level. Okay. So it's not as good as the white type neuron, but it's hard to say they are place cell anymore. Okay, it's still higher chance level okay. Spatial content.
But it seems like it has a lot more information about relative place than absolute place, because if it's firing in systematic sequences, it certainly knows something.
It'd be nice to know, like, if there's a way to characterize
been flooded in space.
How much is the spatial information versus how much is the relative?
That would be great.
But that's exactly how we think place cells work. I mean, Choice can talk about these pre-clegs,
how cells fire and get relative to each other is the internal fundamental dynamics of how the system works, and it has to be the world out there.
This one is floating out of space, and a place cell is not supposed to be floating out of space.
And that's what's telling us what is going on.
I didn't read the title. The title is saying what Jim is saying, actually. So I'll get into the interpretation part a little bit at the end. So,
But that's only a couple of bits. So these cells have almost as much information. If you just tell where to start the sequence, then they carry a lot of information about space. You're just missing the starting.
That's
the internal dynamics.
Right.
It's not space.
Then it may be strongly correlated with space. I mean, if the receptor feels activated in a certain order, it's assuming a constant rate of motion, space and time would be the same.
Yeah, we can certainly discuss that more at the end.
Jim, I had a question.
These cells in the timelines, do they look like your first trial, the first few tracks through the maze, before the animal maze?
No. This is much more severe than that. I show you one example of a novel track place cell, but this is much more severe than that. Okay, so we said the sequence is somehow floating on the track, it's not anchored to place. Then we're asking an even more dramatic question, that is, what if we put the animal in a completely different environment? Okay, so this is when the animal ran the track, I already showed the data. Now, I just put the animal running in open box. The animal just randomly explored the open box, it's doing nothing. It's a kind of random walk. Now we recorded the activity of exactly the same two group of neurons, you know, wild type animal and tail animal. This is a time window of about 1 minute or so. You can look at how the wild type neurons fire while the animal is randomly walking through the track for 1 minute. Because the behavior is random, it's hard to see any sequence. But if you look at the tau animal, you know, the cells, those cells fire sequence when the animal is running the track. But now the same sequence show up when the animal is randomly walking in open box. Often you see this kind of repetitive kind of sequence, but in many cases we cannot really link the sequence to a particular behavior. So we can show you a little bit of analysis here. For each sequence, we identify the start time, end time, and then asking where the animal's locations are. And then we just plot the entire trajectory while sequence is expressing from start to end time. So we plot all those lines, it's just a single sequence-related trajectory. And there's dots, I think one dot is showing the start time and another dot is showing the end time of a particular trajectory. So you can see that the trajectory cover almost entire open box, and there's no regularity there. And also we look at the orientation from the start time to end time, where, you know, what's the trajectory look like. So we align all the start time location here and then just point to the end time location. So it's kind of an orientation that's going everywhere. We don't see a pattern here.
So are the sequences more consistent across environments in the middle than in the wild type?
In the wild type animal, you put it in open box, there's no sequence there.
That's your sequence.
Right. It's hard to find any sequence there because it's random behavior there.
It's even worse. So that's
right. Right.
In the mutant,
the same sequence.
The mutant is the same sequence.
The wild type is no sequence.
There's no sequence.
Right. It's hard to find any sequence.
It's a little bit harder than Gordon Wally. So this phenomenon that the same sequence that is there between neurons, linear track versus open environment.
Mm-hmm.
First question is, what are the stimuli? Because totally different set of.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Saying in your experiment,
you had a certain room with certain stimuli are the same. Are the same neurons active? Because you should have only 10% of neurons common between linear track and open.
Exactly. Yes.
So what was the case? In your case, did you have the same distal visual cues between the linear track and the open?
Well, they are in the same room. I agree. In the same room, but open box has a high wall. I don't think in this case, you know, you're going to see the same stimuli as on linear track. There's a high wall there, and in white type animal, you clearly see the kind of typical remapping phenomenon. You put it in a different environment, you're supposed to have a random group of neurons going to fire, and then you form a new memory trait for that particular space. But mutants look like not.
What percentage of neurons participate in these sequences?
The percentage, I think it's around like 30-50%, depending on each particular experiment. Some neurons, they don't show a clear firing location, right? Some neurons, they show a good place field, but you see the distribution I already show you. So this sequence detection is based on the cross-correlation we computed, then we can identify a template. There are some other neurons. And then in the end, it's about 30-50% of the neurons included in template.
That's similar to the number that I see in a completely non-spatial case conditioning
tasks.
Mm.
Some
30-50%
of neurons
form
sequence.
And so, anyway, you can follow it up later.
Mm.
Have you looked at case conditioning these
days?
No.
I have a similar question. So what percentage of spikes are accounted for by the sequences?
Kind of spikes that I actually haven't computed. You can imagine, you know, open box, and then sometimes you see sequence, sometimes you don't. Presumably you can compute that. But here you clearly see, you know, the sequence just occurs so much more often. You look at it, you definitely see it. You're going to be surprised by looking at that. Most of them are coupled with theta.
My other question was, is the number of sequences maybe correlated, maybe negative, with spatial information? That is the sequence sort of a null state that overrides and impedes spatial processing?
That's a good question. I think we haven't computed. The only analysis we did that those cells, they don't have place field in the open box.
But the question
is whether reversity correlates or not.
The reason why you don't get spatial information is because the system is stuck in this loop.
Exactly. That's what I'm going to get into at the end. So,
is the locomotion of the two animals, the trajectory of the locomotion, the same?
They're quite similar. We tried to identify any behavioral parameters that can explain this kind of thing. We couldn't. In the end, I show you a little bit of data about the behavioral parameters. Okay. All right, so we can also count.
Can I ask you just one tiny question on the same day? So, these animals don't have a tendency to circle, but maybe there was a slight tendency to circle or stay near the boundary. But if the animal was going in one direction along the boundary or in the other direction along the boundary, could you break up your data and look at cases that were in opposite directions in the same set of locations, and still the sequence would be in the same order, which would be really a violation of place fieldness?
I'll get into that on a linear track. And I'll show you a little bit. On a linear track, we do have two trajectories. Yeah. We can look at how the sequence play out in a different trajectory. Okay. It turned out the sequence indeed can distinguish two trajectories. It's not like they don't distinguish two trajectories. Yeah. So this
again showing more data.
You know, we have two more animals. You see this sequence on the track, but the same sequence show up on in the open field. So this kind of robust phenomenon.
This is longer.
What? Say it again.
Sequences made of more neurons are longer, more complex than these are four cells,
right? Yes.
Sometimes we have more,
sometimes we have less. Yes.
In the
control, you see longer sequences because they have a good place field, a reliable cross correlation. Yeah.
But is there any qualitative difference between the sequences between genotypes? Anything from these examples, it looks that in the tau they are more precise.
I don't want to say that they're more precise. On the track,
I would say
white type sequences are very precise, actually. Yeah.
Okay,
just in open box, there's no sequence we can detect. So
but when you see them, they look like the white type series.
They look like this. You know, I feel like they're kind of robust and sometimes repetitive.
No, I'm asking if they're more robust.
It could be, but we haven't quantified that aspect. I don't know how to quantify it or more robust. Maybe you can look at all the cross correlation and maybe you have a better peak. So.
When the animal exhibits one of these sequences when he's in the maze, does he go the same? If he runs faster, does the sequence take shorter to play out, or is it not related to distance travel?
So far, as far as I can see, it seems not related to distance travel. I'll show you a little bit in the end. We'll try to look at the like a spatial pattern.
Is it related to relative distance travel? So if the animal goes from here to here when the sequence is playing, and then he runs faster, is the distance from the first part of the sequence to the second part relative to the third part, the ratios, for example, if the sequence had three parts to it, you could identify are the ratios proportional to the distance traveled?
So as far as I can see, it's more time dependent. So it's like the sequence, it seems to have a more consistent in the time duration. Not necessarily depend on how fast is it running through.
But if the animal runs one part at a sequence, and he runs fast and then slows down.
Oh, okay, I know what you're saying now. Yeah. We haven't quantified that. Presumably, we need a lot of cells to do that.
There's smoke here, right? We might have drawn a smoke, it's very steep. I mean, it should be recorded in the middle of time very fast.
The phase precession is not depending on speed. So, if this have anything to do with phase precession.
Because it seems like you need to figure out what it is, what it's correlated with.
It's
relative distance traveled, absolute distance traveled. Something about this hook to some part of space?
We don't know. But the best explanation that would come up is this kind of stuck cycle of the neurons. So that's what we are hypothesizing.
And when the animal is exploring the box at random, is the sequence about the same actual length as it is when he's running the maze?
You mean it's actually a little bit slower.
It's slightly slower.
Yeah.
How much is slightly? I mean,
I forgot the
exact ratio, but I look at it, I think it's slower. Yes.
It's half as slow or three times slower or what?
Maybe half slower, yeah, the duration. Yeah, I that's not precise. I remember
I did look into it slower.
Yeah.
But is it really when the animal is moving or when
they are actually both. Sometimes when they are moving, sometimes the animal is stopping there. Yeah.
Do you see phase precession when you see this sequence expression in the open box?
Well, somehow in our hand, the phase precession is pretty hard to see in this mouse. We do see phase precession, but that depends on how well the animal is running. If it's running through the phase field really well, very consistently, we do see phase precession. But
what I'm saying, when you get these randomly expressing sequences, so you could still ask whether the first spike that, each neuron there is active for about a couple of seconds, so probably 12, 15 beta cycles. So you can still ask if the first spike arrives
in
your phase, even if you wouldn't do it based on space, but based on time.
We did try, the first couple animals, we tried a little bit, but then we did see phase precession in some of the neurons, but not all of them. It turned out that it critically depends on how the animal running through smoothly. So
that reminds me, so when you are computing these sequences, you say that those data are taken when the rats are sitting or running everything.
It's everything here.
It's just time.
Like we're not looking at position. So when we detection, it just...
To do the analysis, where we take only the running time or only the stopping time and see
Yeah, it's possible. It's possible.
When he's running because they shut.
They occur both behaviors. Sometimes running around, sometimes stopping. And we're also looking at when the animal is resting, sleeping. There's a robust sequence there. I mean, I didn't publish anything.
Let me just check: is the duration of the sequence the same if he's sitting there or moving?
I forgot. That's a very good question. I really forgot. I believe it's similar. There's no dramatic difference.
That would be different for a wild type, where it would be played much faster if you're sitting there.
Right, the wild type,
we don't see this kind of sequence. The best you can see is a ripple-related sequence. It is a much smaller time scale.
Replay in a wild type.
Right.
It's in a maze running.
That is a complete different time scale. That's so much shorter.
This is not a complete different time scale for sure.
Yeah, this is very different from that. This is theta time scale. It's occurred like seconds to 10 seconds.
Is there a logical problem where if you don't have phase precession, if you kind of buy into the normal theories of learning that are caused by sort of repeated, you know, similar phase relationships between the spikes from different neurons, that's the thing that facilitates the formation of the sequence, right? So these animals have bad phase precession, but really robust sequences. Is that a problem?
First, I think it's a different kind of sequence. This sequence has a much larger time scale.
These are place cell sequences.
They're not in time.
But it would be hard to predict it.
Oh, so you're saying that the phase position only predicts the frequently rapid, the rapid.
So the compression of data sequences occurs during data and during the course. They're both compressed. But he's talking about the uncompressed.
This requires a readout mechanism for sequences that on the scale of actual sort of real life time, which is a different mechanism, I guess.
But that's the easy one.
The mechanism to read is just average firing rate. Smooth the firing rate on time scale of 100 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds. And that will get you these sequences. So that readout is not difficult. Getting a place out of it is difficult. But the readout that this was the sequence, you can smooth the firing rate, the ancient, you know.
The brain is generating these sequences regardless of where the animal is. So how does it generate? How does it cause this cell to fire, then this cell to fire, then this cell to fire over and over and over again? There must be some way that there's some causality or some mechanism to change those cells in order at the speed of sort of normal running, regardless of where the animal is.
Nobody knows how that happens, but there's these clear time cells where that's clearly happening, that you have cells that fire at a half second, 1 second, 2 seconds, but nobody knows really how that happens.
We can discuss it later. I think this is a very good topic, and I'm glad that it can trigger this. But I believe there's a number of ways that we can do this. Anyway, so we can count the number of sequences while the animal in the open box, and then compare it with a random shuffle distribution. You can see that the wild type number sequences basically is non-existent, is zero. That's exactly what we expect from chance level. And then the tau animal, you see a dramatic increase in the number of sequences in the open box. Then we ask another question. We see the floating sequence on the track, and also the sequence that failed to remap in the open box, and also existing open box. We're asking whether the sequence depends on experience. Now we test the animal in a novel track, on a novel track, and also in a novel open box. So this is a different track. This is a completely different room. So the animal never been in a room on the track before. So this is the first day of exposure. So you can see that the white type animal. Typical hippocampal place cell behave like this. This is the position, it's a lap. You can see that this particular neuron, the first lap is not there, and after a couple of laps, the cells start to fire and then start to shift forward a little bit to stabilize the position, then stay there for the rest of the laps.
But now you look at the neuron recorded from this tau animal.
They show
the first lap,
but then the location shifts back and forth.
Track.
So this is an unstable firing location, and then we'll look at the multi-cell firing sequence. Again, in a white type of animal where the animal is running a particular trajectory, you see this stable firing sequence always occurs same location, but now you look at the firing sequence in the tau animal, you do see the sequence, but the sequence location shifts forward and backward a little bit, so we don't see a fixed direction of the shifting.
Again, we put the animal in an open box. I have to emphasize a little bit that in this particular animal,
the animal run this open box before they track.
This is also novel. So it's the first time in open box,
and then animal run the track.
Okay. In our
analysis, though,
we identify the template while the animal run the track,
and then we look at how the sequence occur in open box, even prior to the running of the track.
Now,
we still see this kind of firing sequence in open box, even before the animal running the track. So it looks like a sequence is already there, okay, before the
novel running experience.
It's suggesting that a sequence seems not experience dependent. Okay. This is just a similar quantification result that in a familiar environment. Here we see a high level of sequence, and also the sequence shows a lab-by-lab location shift. And also, when the animal in the open box, you see an increase in the number of sequences
in tall animals.
Okay, let's summarize a little bit what I have talked about. So the place cell activity in tau mouse model show a stable firing sequence on familiar and the normal tracks. But those sequences are not anchored
to specific places.
And also fail to remap in completely different environments with a completely different behavior. And also occur in open box even prior to the novel track. So suggesting
the sequence
somehow not location specific, not even space specific. Also not experience dependent. We'll also do some further investigation in the sequence. First we ask, is there any kind of a
spatial or temporal periodicity? Just look at sometimes the sequence show up
multiple times in a given lab or in an open box. Can we find any spatial or temporal pattern there? The answer is no.
So we just,
for each sequence, we take a single time point at the center of the sequence and then plot all the times for all the sequences we identify on the track
in the open box.
And then for that time series data, we just do autocorrelation. That's basically what we show here. So this is the autocorrelation for time, and this is the autocorrelation for distance. In distance, you do see these peaks, but those peaks turned out it's the exact same length of the track, because the behavior is periodic. You know, I'm going to run one track, one lap, and then another lap, another lap. So there's a spatial periodicity there. So it's, in this case, in familiar track, it's 2 meters long.
Temporal domain, you don't see much periodicity because
the animal's
behavior
is less
regular in time. So sometimes spend more time on a particular lab and
spend more time eating. And they'll just average data from all the sessions. So for familiar track, you do see the track length period. But in the tail mouse, you don't see that. So the tail mouse sequence, even not showing the regular track distance periods. That means it's kind of random. It's not tied to a particular location or landmark on the track. For the familiar track, because the track distance, track length is just half the length of the familiar track, you see the
periods now is half
the length of the familiar one in white type animals. This peaks disappear in tau animal. So we also did this for the open field.
We look at the travel distance
periodicity and also the temporal periodicity. We failed to find anything here. So it just means that the sequence seems to show up randomly. Okay. We also get back to this question about theta oscillation here.
Because
there is severe neurodegeneration in the hippocampus, the overall local field potential power is reduced in tau mouse. But then if you rescale, like in this case, you
scale up
the signal a little bit, you see the theta oscillation is very similar. Okay, we can compute a power spectral density and see the tau local field potential has a lower power across all the frequency bands. Then if we can rescale, normalize the power of theta by the total power of the local field potential. Now you can see that this peak is similar to the white type animal. There is a tiny shift in the frequency, though. It's like a 0.5 hertz shift. Except that there's nothing else I can see. You know, there's no dramatic difference in terms of theta. Okay.
Is one type 1 theta, the type 2 theta? Is it possible that the type 1 theta is missing in the tau animal? What you're seeing is just type 2 theta?
I think the both types of
theta similar.
Type 2, you mean the lower frequency, right? The 3 to 4 hertz or something like that.
Okay, it's not that low. It's got to be 1 hertz slower in rats, at least measured by mice. Is it like 6 hertz, 6, 7 hertz is type 2 theta?
You have 6 hertz.
8 hertz is both of them. But actually, what you're asking is already maybe staring at you right there. If you look at it now in the first picture, your left hand side bottom B, you look at 4 hertz.
Mm-hmm.
4 hertz.
You're right here, I mean.
Yeah, or even below. That thing is knocked out completely. All the low frequencies are knocked out massively.
But the whole thing is
gone. Well, the whole thing is.
That's the thing. It's not just theta that is lost. Well, it's the entire low frequency content is gone.
Well, but the dipoles are flattened, right? Because there is more cells. So, how could you calibrate?
Well, the fewer cells are in entorhinal.
No, but what I'm saying is that total amplitude is also going to be given by the geometry of the tissue, and because the dipoles are shorter, you would also assume that
these
are...
So in that case, have you computed the mean firing rate of cells?
They're similar.
Yeah, similar. In the fraction of cells which are actually...
They're all similar.
But that's a funny one.
So was it?
We can get to this, but that... That's not funny. I mean, tissue geometry. I mean, even the histology picture that is showed.
I think all the power across all the frequency bands are reduced.
The 6 hertz
the band, I think it's quite weak, even in a white type band when animals are moving. I believe it's dominated by the 8 to 9 hertz frequency.
How about phase locking of cells? So if you measure cells and you measure phase.
They're all similar.
Similar.
Yeah, they're all similar. Okay, this is the behavioral parameter. We try to identify any obvious behavioral difference that can explain this. So far, we didn't find anyone.
So you're just
showing the trajectory, the white type of animal running the track, and this is a tau animal. This is also showing the position versus time. So it's showing upwards, I mean the animal running one trajectory, and downward, I mean the animal running another trajectory. So all those gaps mean the animal's eating, stopping. You can look at it, the overall pattern is quite similar. When the animal is running open field, there's also the trajectory. Sometimes the animal stops in one place and running around another place, but this also occurs in both white type and tail animal.
And upon
quantify a number of parameters, including the number of laps per session. It turned out in familiar environments, the tail mouse run the less number of laps. It's a small decrease, but in novel environments, they run the same number of laps. And also we compute the travel distance per lap,
and the number of
stops per lap, and stopping duration per lap. And also, more importantly, we computed the average speed. Track in the open box in the familiar room, and track in the open box in the novel room. So the a little bit difference
here, when animal running the track, it turned out running slower.
But in open field, the speed is comparable, and also novel tracks, the speed is comparable. So because the sequences occur in both familiar novel tracks and also both familiar
novel open box,
we don't think this speeds, this little bit change in speed, it can explain what we see. All right, so I show that
there's no period of distance
in terms of the sequence occurs either in the spatial domain or temporal domain. It looks like the state oscillation is normal. We cannot find the simple behavior parameters to explain this. So then we get into this interpretation issue. Well, how do we explain this? For me, the most obvious explanation is that those CA1 neurons,
the
driven strongly by the internal input. You can think about a CA1 as some kind of a recurrent network. The cells there, they all drive each other. And then CA1 neurons at output is also driven by the internal dynamics in CA3. Okay, that's my kind of interpretation. So that means the external drive from entorhinal cortex is not strong enough to perturb this kind of internal dynamics.
Well, that's the same driven by the internal dynamics of MEC, right?
Right.
So the grid cells are also driven by internal
dynamics. They could.
Think that integration models are going to be the drive
on the right? Yeah, originally what we...
It's still a drive on the brain.
I agree with that. So originally we were kind of very excited and whether maybe the CA1 cells now becomes grid cells. You know, we look at all the, but look hard, we couldn't find it. And another reason why we put this is because it turned out in this mouse, the entorhinal cortex, the superficial entorhinal cortex is the first area to degenerate. So presumably the signal from there is weaker than the CS3, but the CS3, on the other hand, is relatively spared in this particular mouse.
Which entorhinal area? So
it is the medial entorhinal cortex, it's a superficial layer, yeah.
The layer 2 and layer 3?
Yeah, both.
So is it possible that there is greater damage in MHC than CA1? Has anybody done comparison to see which is more damaged?
That has not been done. The only statement from this anatomical pathological study is saying entorhinal cortex superficial layer and the CA1 are the first area to degenerate. The CS3 is relatively spared. Yeah. Okay, that means that there's a lot of internal drive to the CA1 neuron. But when we look further, we found that the neurons are not just driven by internal signal. There is some kind of spatial content, as you know, a number of you just commented. So first, if you look at the firing location, you know, sometimes there's some kind of stability among different labs.
Especially the neighboring labs.
Like the cell fire here and here. And also, if you look at the sequence location, often you see this neighboring labs, the sequence occurred exact same location, but then they shift away after a few labs. So there is a special content there.
Exactly what I was asking you to see. If you were looking at trial by trial versus a cross random trial, you should see some stability.
We quantify that. We randomly shuffle them around. And to compare the spatial information, it turned out they contain slightly higher spatial information than random shuffle. There is some kind of a spatial information there. So that's what I'm saying. It's not just internal. So the location, sometimes it can be stable across a few labs. But we didn't see a kind of systematic shift in, like, from always forward and backwards. That's something we looked hard, we didn't see it. Yeah, then we quantified, we couldn't see. I mean, show you this. Okay, and also
there's another line of evidence to show
that it's not just internal, you know, there's also some kind of external drive.
It's getting to the question that
Bartlett asked about, you know, if you look at a template on one trajectory to see whether the template occurs on another trajectory. So the exact experiment like this. So in our recording, the animal is running the track one session, and then there's a 15 minutes break. Animal run another session, which is exactly the same track for another 15 minutes. So this is two sessions per day. So when we do analysis, we can look at a template on one trajectory, make a template for one trajectory, and then count the number of sequence on the trajectory itself. We call it a self count, okay? And then we also can count the number of sequences on the same trajectory but in different session. So we just test the stability. What if you've been out 15 minutes, whether the sequence occur on the same trajectory. And also we can count the sequence on the other trajectory but within the same session. So to see whether the sequence can tell the difference between two trajectories. So what we found that indeed in both wild type and a tau animal, the sequence on a trajectory is quite stable. That means you bring the animal out for 15 minutes and put back the same trajectory, you still get a high number of counts, sequence counts. So it's a stable, okay? But then if we count the sequence on the other trajectory, those wild type and the mutant animals show a very low count.
But that means the sequence.
Even though they're floating in a white in a mutant animal, but can still tell the difference from one trajectory from another. Okay, so it can distinguish two trajectories.
In what way? I mean, if it is a sequence ABCD, what does it mean for it to the ABCD to distinguish between this right now? Like they distinguish in terms of
speed, but you're not distinguishing that.
I'm saying those sequences mainly internally driven,
but can be cued
by external.
There's still some kind of
external input. It's not just internal. So that's the kind of a statement I try to make here.
If you define sequences A, B, C,
D, right,
and you're saying it's A, B, C, D looks different when you go this way than when you go this way. What does that mean?
No, A, B, C, D just not occur on other trajectory. You just count. It's just not there. That's what I mean. Yeah.
It doesn't go DCBA.
No. Okay. So our interpretation here is that we believe
to see one neuron in the
transgenic animal is mainly driven by internal input. Maybe it's originating in CS3, but there's also external component. So somehow the activity is still influenced by the sensory input, presumably through the entorhinal cortical input. Okay. So this brings to
the kind of question we asked in the beginning.
You know, we said memory retrieval, that external cue actually cause some kind of internal reactivation of memory code. In normal cases, those two always agree with each other, so that is the correct memory trace. But in this case, and this kind of a pathological condition, even though you have a new external input, the internal input, internal drive is so strong, it dominated activity of CA1 neurons. So in this case, external input still recover some kind of memory or information already stored in the internal circuit. So this can cause like a memory
intrusion, right?
You're getting into a completely different environment, even though you're getting a new sensory input, but your internal drive is so strong, you're still recovering what's already stored there. This probably can explain the kind of phenotype that we usually see in the
Alzheimer's disease patient. That is
the inability to form new episodic memory, that is, you get a new space, you're not forming a new memory trait for that particular space. Instead, you can recover the information already stored in the circuit, maybe recover, cause some kind of retrieval of the old memory. So you have a memory intrusion in Alzheimer's disease patient, which is often seen in those people. Thank you.
That's going to the end of my talk.
So the work in the end I talked about is mainly done by this two students. So Sarah did the a lot of histology and also some of the recording, but the main recording done by Qing. Okay, thank you.
So the mouse model is transgenic?
The transgenic. So
this
abnormal protein start to show up around 2 weeks after birth. People believe there's very little developmental issue here, but that's complicated. I mean, now people believe that the kind of preline is not that clean, but in general, we believe this is not a
developmentally
developed disease. So it's caused by the abnormal processing of the tau protein introduced later in life.
So when you put a rat from the original maze into the open box, which is obviously a very different environment, the sequence stays there.
Mm-hmm.
But when you put it on the same track in the opposite direction, mm-hmm. the sequence goes away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting.
It's interesting to me.
The
open
box would be more different.
I think it depends on what the animal is doing. When the animal is on the track, he's more motivated looking for food, or he probably pay more attention to the environment. In the open box, there's a lot of random walk going on there. I think it's not that surprising to me that the animal, a dumb animal can tell the difference between two trajectories rather than a tracker with open box. So I think it's.
So I find that one observation quite crucial. I showed one slide that when you look at certain blocks of data, then the cell has clear place speed there. It seems to be stable. And when it shifts around, it's going between those couple of places. I find that really important.
I think it's important, that's why in the end.
Is there anything more about that to quantify that it's necessarily? I mean, there are so many things one could ask exactly there. Is it stable? Where is there a typical time scale over which it is stable? Is it stable for 2 trials, 10 trials? Or is it random? Or the other question then would be, does it necessarily have just 2 place fields in it shifting? Or 1 place field? Or
we compute the number of place fields per lab. It turned out the wild type and the mutant animal, they show similar number of fields per lab. In terms of like how stable, how many labs are going to stay, we haven't quantified that. But the only thing we did is we say it's not completely random. We did the controlled randomly shuffling around, and then it's obvious that they're not random. There's still some spatial content there. But how exactly, how long they can stay there, that's not, we haven't quantified that.
Yeah.
We could do that.
Develop techniques, I can send you the codes and so on, where we looked at that exactly. How long is the stability persisting and changing? When the space is selective, it may be hard to define. In your case, you can still do it.
Yeah, that's interesting, yeah. We could do that, yeah.
So do you see the same sequences day to day?
Yes. But not necessarily same neurons. It's hard to track the same neurons.
Same set of.
Yeah. We still find the same phenomena from one day to another. Yeah.
Not the same cells.
Not necessarily the same cells. Yeah.
So when the animal moves one direction, you have a sequence. When he moves the other direction, that sequence disappears, but another sequence appears.
Yes.
But in the open platform, then when he's walking around, which of these two sequences is expressed? The forward one, backward, or both?
So whenever we have a template, we just compute how often that occurs in the open box. Then we show you the average result. In the end, is most of the template sequence on the track that show up in the open box. So that means both of them. Yeah.
Have you looked whether in the open box there are other sequences which are neither the forward direction or reverse direction? Is that all there is to it in open box?
I'm sure there are sequences, but it's hard to quantify them. It's just hard to come up with a template in open box with random behavior. We couldn't come up with a reliable template to study that. But I'm sure there are other sequences.
Given enough computing power and time, you should be able to identify repeatable sequences of cells that fire in a particular order, right? It's convenient to have a template that you can find, look for that, and makes it faster, but give yourself a cluster of computers and lots of time, you should be able to determine, right, whether there are repeating sequences of cells that are different from your predefined sequences, right?
Yeah, this is how exactly we did. So we can take a spike pattern, and we can identify all those peaks of the cell, and then we just line up with in the end, it's a long sequence. And what you said, could be done, but unfortunately we haven't done it. So we can look at the entire sequence, what's the regular pattern. Actually, okay, we got an undergraduate student from Rice and try to do this. We work out using a Markov chain model, try to figure out how the transition probability, but we didn't get it done. So that is a good question, yeah.
So you altered that here study partly by this remedy for Alzheimer's disease.
Yes.
But this mutation, as far as I understand, is more a model for frontotemporal dementia, which has distinct clinical features relative to Alzheimer's disease, and also is distinct in molecular and cellular properties. For example, this mutation would show normal or enhanced long-term compensations, whereas ABP mutations is showing reduced. Have you also checked more commercial APP?
Yeah, we did a lot of recording also with the APP model too.
And do you see the same type of model?
No, they're very different type of phenotype.
What do you see in those?
In those, they show a less precise place field. And more importantly, the place field starts the normal in novel environment, but then you train the animal over and over again. The wild type show very nice place field, but the mutant animal failed to develop a high quality place field. The sequence is always there, just like white type. So, yeah. I agree that there's no good model for Alzheimer's disease at this time. Either APP model or the tau model is all no good. But I believe that the kind of behavioral phenotypes occur at the either in patients or animals, probably largely, or I don't know how to say this, maybe largely due to the tau pathology and neurodegeneration. So that's why we study this first.
So has this kind of sequence formation been seen in any other mutant mouse model?
Well, the sequence is going to be seen in any white type animal, right? If you have a good place field, you're going to see this. But this kind of floating sequence, not that I know. I mean, the other day, Jim talked about I thought it's related to it, but apparently it's not. So.
Well, I think there is evidence in normal animals that there are not sequences per se, but the idea that the internal dynamics, that the space representations and their relationship with each other are internally coherent, even when there's plenty of visual cues out there or other kind of cues, that the whole representation can shift relative to any external sensory cue. And I think what's going on here is that's just consistent with the story.
But this just happened at a much, much smaller time scale.
That's right. Yeah, and this is showing that the precise temporal sequence is at a very fine temporal scale. So I think I think it's going to be, we'll show again from George later on, you know, also similar things are showing there's lots of, I think the evidence is overwhelming that you're talking about the internal dynamics, whether it's this CA1 internal dynamics or CA3 or we don't know. It's probably a combination of all of them. But clearly these spatial presentations, there's something that shows a spatial and temporal coherence of how this network updates itself as it goes around is clearly there, which can be completely removed from any external sensory input. And the question then becomes, you know, in a normal animal, how does this get locked to a specific time in case of a timing cell or a specific location in case of a place cell? It is an interesting and another important question it's hard to know what's going on exactly these days here. I think it could just be the lack of the tying of the sequences to a spatial location. It could actually be a disruption in the updating of the system.
Yeah.
So there has to be some kind of game function that will, in terms of a pattern integration system, that translates the speed of the movement of the animal to the speed of updating of this representation. And that is something that may be tunable, and maybe that system is disrupted. And anything like that disrupts the mapping or the game function of updating of speed or time in the world with this updating of the brain representation can also be messed up in this system, and if that's what then prevents the system from then having some kind of consistency with the world out there, the external cues to calibrate things and keep them updated, then that's going to get you, I think, phenomena like you're seeing here, and I think either one of those can or both of them can be disrupted in your mice. But so understanding exactly why the patterns you have on where they are, I think, is the difficult question to address, and partly because there's so much damage.
We try to do more recording in CS3 and the rhino cortex and see if we can find something.
Really clearly, this idea that there is something internal to the system that is very precise, but it's we have to know what. It's free floating in space and perhaps time in ways that it's going to be difficult to address with this particular mouse model.